Okay, so we now move into the book of Shemos, the second book of the Torah. And plenty of material in Shemos to study and to analyze. I think we'll start off with, I like the heroes. You know, Yosef, one of our heroes. And of course, if we're talking about Shemos, it's pretty obvious who the hero is.
Right.
Moshe Rabbeinu.
Yeah.
Okay, he's the hero. The greatest, the chief of the prophets.
Right.
So what I would like to do is take up the very first Sedra, in the bush, which is called Shemos. The book is always called after the name of the first, you know, basically the first name, first one or two or three words in the book.
Why not Vayera?
That's a good point. That's a good point. Because you got to have the background.
Okay.
You got to, you know, I'd rather start with because this is a significant.
Beginning.
Yeah, like who is Moshe Rabbeinu? What's his character? What's his nature?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as you know, the Torah is really not a book of history. It's not a historical work, and it's not a biographical work. Although it does contain some information that is historical, but it's only there because of the lessons it conveys. The Torah is only interested in teaching us lessons of how to relate to God, how to perfect ourselves, you know, matters of that sort. So it's going to contain information that's relevant to that. But information that's going to, you know, give us knowledge, there will be historical insights because sometimes the two paths converge. But in general, it's not interested in conveying historical information unless it has a moral purpose. So with regard, you could see that in the case of Moshe, arguably the most important person in the entire Torah. And you'd like to know his biography. I'm sure there's a lot more. There's much more we would all like to know. But you don't know. You don't know. The truth is, you don't really know the characters in the way that we would want to know people. You don't know their personality. What kind of person was he like? Was he easygoing? Did he have a sense of humor? What kind of jokes did he make? You're not going to get anything about anyone on that. Because that's persona. Not that the Torah doesn't, not that we're saying that it has no value or that it's not important. It's just that's not the goal of the Torah. Okay, the moral core, however, is something different. Now, let's start off the Torah. The Torah tells us two incidents in the life of Moshe. So let's start off with the first one. Okay, so we know essentially, that's a fascinating story, the manner in which his life was saved. He was saved. He wasn't, according to all considerations, he really should not have lived. There was a decree of infanticide. And that led the parents to take this measure, which is a strange measure altogether, but it worked, whatever the case is. There was divine protection. And then, miraculously, he's spotted by the daughter of Paro. And it would appear that that she was a humane individual because she knew that the child was a Jew and she knew that the father's decree was that all the Jewish male children had to be cast into the water, had to be killed. And she resisted. She refused to do it. And then Miriam appeared. And Miriam's action was also very significant because at that very moment she appears and asks her if she wants her to get a Jewish, because since the child is Jewish, the assumption is that either the mother is available, some Jewish woman gave birth to a child so she can nurse, or there might be nursing women that did that. And preferably from the Jews. So that's another important twist because it turns out that as a result of that, the mother, not only is the child saved, but the very mother gets to be the one who nurses the child. Which is very, very significant. But I'm just going to go through that quickly now. That part. And then the child is weaned. The child is brought to the daughter of Pharaoh. Apparently, she was able to sway her father on this, then not to kill the child, to allow her to raise the child. Now you could, at first you could ask the question, if Pharaoh's decree was to, you know, kill all the Jewish males, so why would he make an exception in this case? All right, so that's not the biggest question in the world, because you could just say that when it comes to your own children, it's different. There's always exceptions. But she might have argued that this would be good for his policy, because it's always good to have someone. If you want to entrap a people, that's the way, even in Germany, in the concentration camps, they would get the Jews to be the foreman over the rest of the Jews, the so-called capos. So she could have argued that way, that if we have a Jew who's an outstanding individual, first of all, it's good for Egypt. They weren't like Hitler. They weren't racially anti-Semitic. They had seen that the Jews can produce some great people like Yosef, whatever the case may be. So she's permitted to raise the child, which is very important, because he is saved from the enslavement. He never experiences enslavement. You can see that in his personality throughout the entire period of his life of leadership of the Jews. Whereas the Jews do, even after the Exodus, they still evince certain aspects of the slave mentality, which is a big problem. But Moshe was saved from the slave mentality. He never experienced slavery. Very important. So these are small, we're gleaning certain pieces of information. Now we could see his greatness. Then it says that he grew to be a man, which is essentially, I guess, around 13 years old or so. We don't know the exact. And then it says that he went out to see how his brothers were doing. This is in, if you're following, this is in Shemos chapter 2, verse 11. It says that Moshe grew up and he went out to his brothers and he saw them in their labors, and he saw an Egyptian man hitting a Jewish man from his brothers. This is a very fascinating sentence. It tells you a lot. I mentioned that there's this whole movement recently. You don't hear that much about it now, but there was very recently, among the black groups or the civil rights groups to sort of revise history. And people, because there were people in this country who were great people, but still in all, they did partake of slavery. I think Thomas Jefferson and others, people who in general would be considered great people and moral people, nevertheless, they went along with the morality of the times. Now, therefore we should change the entire attitude towards them, you know, the tearing down of the statues of these people. So that's a very interesting subject. My point is that it was wrong. What they did was wrong. But sometimes well-meaning people, there's a certain aspect of people that they sort of accept. There are certain things that you accept. It comes with the turf. It's the morality of the times. So that the world had only progressed so far. I mean, you see even the whole attitude towards women and women's rights and women. It's only very recent, even in America, that women have the right to vote, not to mention all the other things that they can do in the army, and then they could be a fighter pilot. So are we saying, therefore, that 100 years ago, all the people over here were chauvinists and didn't believe in freedom and equality? No, but certain things evolved. That was the attitude of society for centuries and centuries. You know, it establishes a certain role for people, and people don't come along necessarily and question it. Of course, slavery is an evil, but even that was sort of tolerated, and people come along, and people just tend to accept it. Okay, so I would say they can still be good people. This is a flaw, but I wouldn't condemn them, because it wasn't due to their own inner corruption or wickedness. It was simply certain things they just accept, because it's part of the landscape of the times. So you see, I would say they had the same thing in Egypt. The same thing in Egypt. Once the slavery of the Jews becomes established, so people tend to accept it. But you see, Moshe Rabbeinu was unique. there are certain unique individuals who didn't accept it, who thought for themselves, and who recognized that slavery was wrong. And the fact that everyone's doing it, and this is a part of the structure of society, doesn't mean a thing. It's intrinsically evil. It's wrong. See, Moshe Rabbeinu had that the fact that it was done, that it was part of the society, and so didn't deter him. He needed to see for himself. It's interesting also that he knew by this time that the Jews were his brothers. And not only did he know that they were his brothers technically, because why should he identify with them? He was a prince in Egypt. He could go his own way. But I would say that he had made contact with his family, with his mother, with his sister, with his brother, and they had imbued in him a certain type of an identification with the Jews. So he went out to see for himself. What's the story? He didn't automatically assume that it was wrong, because he wanted to study the causes. How did it come about? What's the idea behind it? And so forth. So that led him, which is part of the greatness, part of his greatness itself, is the fact that he had an independent mind and he wanted to know and to understand before he did anything.
You're getting that all from Yud Aleph?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reading between the lines. I'm saying if the Torah records it, it's very important. And what is important is that you see that many Jews who become very successful in the world at large and they become assimilated. So do they, when the Jews are in trouble, like during the Holocaust, do they raise their voices and call out, or do they forget, the fact that it's their brothers doesn't mean anything to them. They identify more with the society. And right. To the contrary, right?
Right.
Yeah, they don't want to emphasize the fact. They want to hide. You go back, like many of the leading Hollywood movie makers, producers, and so on and so forth, were Jews in inordinate amount. But Cecil B. DeMille and this one, it's hard to find the Jewish name. They all changed their names so they wouldn't be recognized as Jews. I don't think that's the... Because today everything is about being ethnic and so on and so forth. So you see a lot of people that have very blatantly Jewish names. So I think that era of changing your name, getting a non-Jewish name is kind of past. Okay, but Moshe Rabbeinu went to see what was going on. It is interesting that there's a redundancy. What word over here is being repeated, seemingly unnecessarily? You got to be sensitive to the nuances of the verses, because it says that Moshe Vayetze Alecha, he went out to his brothers and he saw them in their afflictions. And then it says, and he saw an Egyptian man hitting a Jewish man from his brothers. So why does he, we know it's from his brothers. Why does that word have to be repeated? That second usage of that word is clearly superfluous. So hold on, I'll come back to that. Then it says that he turned around, he looked this way and that, and he saw that there was no man, which this also has many implications, but you got to understand the plain meaning. And he smote, he hit the Egyptian, and he buried him in the sand. So on the plain level, I understand why he looked all around, because he didn't want to be caught. So he wanted to see that the coast was clear. Okay, that's an important factor. So he saw that there was no man. And then he smote the Egyptian and he buried him in the sand. So I want to suggest why it uses the word brother. See, the word brother is very crucial over here. As I said, that he retained his identity with his brothers. They still mattered to him, even though he was in a position where he could have forgotten all about them, or even that it would be detrimental. It was detrimental because as a result of this, he had to leave the country. He basically gave up everything at that point in order to save the Jew. See, but the Torah is telling us there's two points at which he saw the feeling of brotherhood was, first of all, before he went out. At that point in time, he had to decide, do I really care about these people or not? He could have stayed in the palace and not even bothered to look into this matter. But no, there was the feeling of brotherhood was strong enough to cause him, to motivate him to go out and see. Okay, that's the first. See, but then there's a lot of people that might care enough to investigate and see what's going on. Yeah, but let's say you discover that there's a real problem and that the solution is not easy and that they, in order for you to help them, you really have to do something which puts your own life at risk. Are they still your brothers? Are they still your brothers at that point? See, that's why it has to use the word twice, that the degree of brotherhood was not only the amount which would motivate him to look, but was powerful enough when action needed to be taken. And he clearly knew that this was a dangerous action because he looked all around. And the Torah is telling you that, yeah, that they were still my brothers, even to the extent that I have to do an action for them. And then you'll see, I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of Jewish organizations. And then, oh, there's been a resurgence of anti-Semitism. So when there is a anti-Semitic incident, oh, so they'll come out and they condemn whatever the case may be. Now, I don't know what it means that they condemn this. You know, the Anti-Defamation League condemns the murder of Jews. Well, what do you mean you condemn it? What does that do? What does that accomplish? What's the point? I never understood that. Unless it's followed by some action, if there's an implication that when you condemn something, you're going to do something about it and it's going to matter, okay, but you don't do it. Anyone can say they condemn something. It's meaningless. So why don't they go further? Well, that's as far as we're going to go. So you see that the brotherhood and the desire to protect or to fight against anti-Semitism has its limits. And you have more courageous souls. People that don't just condemn it, but they go out and they take action. Maybe they'll do a protest. I don't know. A protest is something when you take to the streets and you protest. Or maybe they'll form a self-defense organization and actually produce some type of security. You see what I'm saying? So that's why I think it's telling you that even when he saw that the Jew was in trouble and needed help immediately, he still was his brother. Okay, fine. Let's continue. Let's proceed. Then it says he went.
I mean, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
It seems like for the most of the time that he was alive before he vayetzed out of Paro's house, that he was actually being raised by his family, the mother of the boy. So.
No, we don't. Yes. It says she. No, we don't know that. It says that when he got older and he was weaned, how old could he have been? 2-3 years old? And then the mother dutifully, because that was the agreement, brought him to the daughter of Paro. So from that point on, you don't know. I have a theory that.
In Yudalef, it says he grew up. So I'm sorry.
It mentioned it twice. There was two growing ups. One is to reach the point where he could be weaned. The other one was where he was like already, a functioning individual.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. Then it says that he went out on the second day, and now he saw two Jews fighting. Yeah. And he said to the wicked one, apparently the attacker, the assailant, Russia, wicked one, why are you hitting your friend? And he answered, who made you into a person? A judge, a ruler and a judge over us. Do you intend to kill me just like you killed the Egyptian? And Moshe was afraid and he said, behold, the matter has become known. This is an amazing kind of a development. The first question we have to ask is a simple question. How did this guy know? This was not the same guy that was there yesterday. So if the Torah says that he looked all around and he saw that there was no man, we can assume that there was no man. I mean, you know, otherwise why tell us that? That we can assume that Moshe had a good view and that his assessment that there was nobody watching was a good assessment. If that's the case, how did this guy find out? Because this guy wasn't there. Clearly was not there. Any thoughts on that? Look, you can always project onto that there was somebody hiding behind, but that... That's not a proper approach. Because the Torah doesn't tell us. Sorry?
I'm sorry. I thought I was trying to answer the question, but I didn't know that you were still talking.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was thinking that maybe, like, clearly the person that his life saved, he told somebody else.
Yeah, why do you say that?
Because, like, imagine that traumatic event happening to you and someone saving your life. Like, you know, you're going to tell the story. It's your story. And then it's like a game of telephone, like, you know.
But let me ask you a question. Wouldn't that endanger him as well? That is, if he would have reported this, to if the matter became known, then I guess he would be in jeopardy too, because he didn't do anything to save the Egyptian, and he just, you know, he participated, so to speak. Or I don't think I'd want to be found out by the Egyptian police, because they'd ask you, well, why was he hitting you? What crime did you commit that would make him want to hit you? And secondly, what did you do when Moshe slew this person? Did you come to the aid of the Egyptian? So my point is, I hear what you're saying, but I think you have to add a little bit of something to it. That theory has, by the way, right? Chait also said that theory, that I just want to add to that, because you learn something very, very powerful from here. It would have to have been the one who was saved. But we don't assume that the one who was saved would want to get Moshe in trouble. He saved his life. Secondly, as I say, the smartest thing is keep your mouth shut. Why do you want anybody to know that you were involved in something like that? So I would add like this, and that is, you see, many, many times, like I always say, a person's worst enemy in this world is basically his own mouth. Most of the things that a person, or and his best friend, most of the troubles that a person gets into, you'll see, he just talked too much. And then the person who he told it to and who he trusted, turns out that he couldn't, it wasn't a good decision. So we talk too much. That's because there's a very powerful need. I understand that. And there are certain things that if you can't tell it to someone, it's like painful. It's like it's not even worth happening. Something really great happens to you. You have at least one person, maybe a couple of others that you just got to share it with. And as I said, it's very painful. And it's really the kind of thing that if you can't share it with anyone, it's like it's not the same thing anymore. So this fantastic thing happened to him, and he was bursting. He had to tell somebody. So what I would say is like this. The way these things happen is, so he tells one person. And he tells that person, but you have to understand, you can't tell anybody. And the other person who wants to hear it, he agrees, of course not. Then he tells it to him. But now that other person is in the same position that you're in. He has this piece of information that, you know, like he's got it. What does he do? He finds one person. And then before you know it, everybody knows. So that's a very significant kind of thing. That the matter became known. And now, see what Moshe saw. What did Moshe see, though, on this day? Two incidents. One pertaining to the persecution, the Egyptian persecution of the Jews. The second one told him something about the Jews. And that is, because when he says, I see that the matter is known, so Rashi mentions a midrash. That is, on a deeper level, what he's saying to himself, now I understand something I didn't understand before. And that is, why is this, people of all the nations, why did they deserve to fall into this slavery, to have this happen to them? He says, now I know. Now I understand. That is, he discovered a very serious weakness of the Jews. That is, that instead of resisting against the real enemy, they turned on each other. And they turned on him. They turned on him. What right did you have to kill the Egyptian? So they were identifying with the Egyptians instead of with the one who resists, who fought on the behalf of the Jews. Instead of and because they couldn't take the criticism. They couldn't take the criticism, so they turn on each other.
Which criticism?
Because Moshe said, "What right do you have to hit your friend?" He rebuked. I would use the word rebuke. So the Jews were incapable of taking rebuke, And instead, that, and they, in addition to that, they identified more with their enemies than with their brothers. They didn't have, you can contrast Moshe's sense of brotherhood with the Jews' lack of a sense of brotherhood. Therefore, here you are. I mean, the whole world is attacking us. So why are we fighting with each other? But that, unfortunately, you'll find that in all of the various periods, even during the Holocaust. Crazy kinds of stories where Jews could not get together.
Well, I mean, there was a whole Judenrat.
Yeah, I'm saying that's true. That's true. That's true. I'm saying even in America, Jewish organizations in America, that they, you know, tried to bring them together in order to, you know, to increase their strength, their influence. But the politics, there's such politics that this organization can't work with this organization. This one can't work with the other one. So that those partisan differences trumped over the, you know, this was the crisis of right. the day. Anyways, okay, so you see, so what happens? So then it says that Paro heard. See, eventually Paro was going to hear because they couldn't keep their mouths shut. And they weren't, they didn't have that, see, I would say Paro heard. So I'm just speculating, but it could be, yeah, there are Jews that wanted him to hear. Oh, because look how loyal we are to the state. There were Jews like that. There were Jews that tried to show they cooperated with the Germans.
Ingratiate themselves?
Yeah, to ingratiate themselves. It sounds preposterous, but it's true. In order not just to save themselves, but to prove their loyalty. Oh, the Jews in Germany, they identified as Germans. They had this tremendous sense of loyalty to Germany. And they could never imagine. Well, look, no, who can imagine that this could happen to anyone? But in addition, because they were so loyal, they regarded themselves as Germans. They had served in World War I, and they contributed so much to the country. So they regarded themselves as Germans. They couldn't believe that the country would turn against them like that. Okay. And the same is true of Jews in America. We're first beginning to open our eyes because of the increase of these incidents. But we too have that feeling that we're Americans and that America, it is true, by the way, it's still true in terms of the America and the government and so forth, because the anti-Semitism over here is not stemming from the government or anything like that. That's from other sources. And the Jews are very, very well protected and, you know, support for Israel and so on and so forth. Yeah, but there are certain changes taking place. Who knows where this could lead? You got to live with your eyes open if you're Jewish. Okay, so he escapes. So he escapes to Midian. It says that in verse 15, and Moshe ran away from before Paro, and he dwelled in the land of Midian, and he dwelled by the well. Okay. Now, we don't know when this next incident takes place. Because, you know, the Torah covers a lot of years in a single sentence. Because the next thing we know is that Moshe is returning to Egypt. That's after he has the encounter with God and the burning bush. And he argues with God. According to the rabbis, he argues for 7 days. Until he's really forced. God doesn't really give him much room. And he has to assume the leadership position. When he returns to Egypt, he's 80 years old. When he begins his leadership, his mission, he's 80 years old. So how many years did he spend in Midian?
About 65.
Yeah, there's speculation. That depends on how old was he when he killed the Egyptian and ran away. So it could be anywhere from, say, 12, 13 to 20, around his teenage. He was basically a teenager. So if that's the case, it could be 60, 65 years or so, give or take. Okay. Now, at what point the next incident occurs, we don't know. That takes place during that time period in which he's dwelling in Midian. See, we also know that in Midian, he was a loner. He was a real loner. He kind of withdrew from any kind of social life, certainly from political life. He was a stranger, because we know that from the fact, the name that he gives to his first son, who's called Gershom, which is made up of two Hebrew words, Gershom, a stranger there, which meant, and the reason he says, because I was a stranger in a foreign land. So that's,
I mean, about it. It's so interesting. What possible, it seems like the only real exposure you could possibly have to Yahados or anything like that would have been before he was 13 years old with his mother. And not even that, before he was 3 years old. Then he spent his life with the princess, and he went out, and he killed the Egyptian, and he left. So how in Midian is he in touch with his roots?
Well, I would say you have to understand the tremendous level, the tremendous intellectual genius level of Moshe, that he had access. Another reason why possibly God saw to it that he was raised in the palace. Because in the palace, he had access to all of the great thinkers of Egypt. So that if it's true that as a youth, he returned to his parents' house and he absorbed all of their teachings, in addition to that, he absorbed the teachings of Egypt, of all the Egyptian scholars, so that when he went off, he was already very, very accomplished intellectually. So he kept on with his studies. How, we don't know the particulars. I would say that's why, because at first glance, why is that the name? What's so great about being a stranger in a foreign land? So I would say it's because, like the Rambam says, that to be a great prophet, you have to be able to spend a certain amount of years in isolation, to completely remove yourself from all of the societal influences, and to focus purely on the abstract ideas which lead a person closer and closer to God. You see, when he comes out of this period, he's on the level of being, then God pierced him, he's a prophet. So therefore, he continued to develop. A prophet, according to the Rambam, has to be at a very high intellectual level, okay, and morally perfected. So at a certain point in time, you understand that people that want to, or intellectuals, whatever the case may be, there's always going to be a certain tension over there, because they want to discover ideas. But they want to discover ideas for what reason? Oh, if most of them, is because they want the rewards. They want the fame. They want the recognition. To the extent that a person is motivated by the need for recognition, to that extent, he's diverted from abstract truth, because he needs the approval. And he's going to take the pathways which he believes are more inclined, that people are going to like. So you have many people like that. And the ones who are purely in the world of truth will come up with ideas that are not appealing to people's emotions. Those are the truly great thinkers, like Abraham. Abraham was on one side, and the entire world was on the other side. That means he had that greatness to be able to follow the path of reason wherever it led him, and he came up with conclusions which were extremely unpopular. He broke down the entire system of idolatry, which had a powerful hold on mankind at that time. So that's a characteristic. I mean, many of the great innovators in science and so on and so forth have been Jews, like Freud, for example. His ideas were extremely innovative, and they were extremely unpopular. Boy, was he hated. He was really hated. But that ability.
Abraham was
hated, but so was I. I was using as an illustration in our recent history, Freud.
Right.
Different area completely. I'm not making a comparison between the two. I'm just showing that characteristic of being able to put aside the opinions of mankind and to follow the truth wherever it leads, even when it leads to extremely unpopular results, does seem to be, it's not only Jews. I mean, you'll find other thinkers. But it is a trait of the great Jewish thinkers. Let's take up the next incident, though. Then it says that, and I want you, as we go through, to see if you could spot any of the questions. It says the Kohen of Midian had seven daughters. That individual, his name is Yisro. He had a bunch of these. He's referred to by a bunch of different names. Okay, so the daughters, apparently they were the shepherds. These seven daughters were the shepherds. And they came and they drew water. And they filled up the watering holes to water the sheep of their father. Okay, then it says, and the shepherds came and drove them off, drove them away. So Moshe arose and saved them, and he watered the sheep. Okay, so they came to Reuel, that's Yisro's, as I said, he's known by different names, their father. And he said, why have you come home so quickly? Why have you arrived so quickly today? So they said, an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds, and he also drew the water for us, and he watered the sheep. So he said to his daughters, and where is he? Why then did you abandon this man? He rebuked them. Call to him that he may eat. In other words, why did you abandon him? Why didn't you invite him in for a meal? He did you such a big favor. Yeah, you know, you have to reciprocate. Then it says, what?
What? Why? He's evidently living like an Egyptian to some degree.
Okay, so therefore?
What, how do you square their perception of him living like an Egyptian with him, I don't know, having fled Egypt because he was so...
They don't know that he's fled Egypt. I don't know if they know that much about him, but apparently he retained that outer image. He dressed like an Egyptian, I suppose. Well, what else is he going to... Well, I'm not sure what else should he dress like. That's the culture he's coming from. Yeah. Okay. But he was rebuking them for failing to invite him. Then it says, the next thing we know, that Moshe agreed to stay with the man. And he gave him Tzipora, his daughter. Yisro's daughter, Tzipora, became the wife of Moshe. And she gave birth to a son. And he called his name Gershom, for he said, I was a stranger in a foreign land. Okay, the next thing we read about is the encounter at the burning bush. This story itself, this is the second incident in the life of Moshe that the Torah is conveying. And on the surface, it seems pretty similar, right? Pretty similar to the first one, like Moshe to the rescue. Moshe to the rescue. However, I would say that there are certain differences over here. So anybody, what are some of the questions you might ask pertaining to this second incident?
Why is he hanging out by the well waiting for this to happen? And what's he doing there?
I don't get that. I don't know that he was hanging out by the well waiting for this to happen. I would imagine that he was looking for peace and quiet. And maybe the well was a little bit outside. They would water the sheep there. Maybe it was a little bit outside of the city and so on and so forth. The way I understand that he happened to be there, this incident occurred and he responded, but not that he was looking for this to happen. But there are problems in the behavior of Moshe, I would say. But what are the main differences? What are the main differences between this incident and the saving of the Jew from the Egyptian? So let me point it out.
So can I take a stab at this?
Yeah.
There's a main similarity in that there are two kind of vulnerable people who are being victimized, so to speak. In one case, it's the Egyptian over the Jew. In another case, it's these shepherds over these, you know, women who are trying to water their sheep.
Why is that so important, though? That doesn't really seem to matter. In both cases, you have a victim that's being taken advantage of by someone stronger. So what's the difference? In one case, it's a Jew. In one case, it's these girls. And why? True, that's a difference, but you have to show the significance of that difference. Here's what I would point out. I have a few questions on this. And that is, of the two incidents, I understand Moshe's behavior in the first one makes more sense for a number of reasons. First of all, there was a real danger. That is, I assume that this Jewish man who was being beaten, his life was in danger because he could kill him. And maybe he was intending to kill him, but his life is in danger. You're being beaten, So I understand the motivation. So Moshe had to intervene if he's going to save this guy's life. And since he believed that it was his brother and he was an innocent victim, and Judaism really demands that you shall not stand idly by the blood of your brother. That is, if a Jew is in danger, you have to, and you could do something to help, you have to do that. So I understand. But in this second situation, what was the danger they were in? Were these girls in any danger?
Potentially.
Why? Why? It says they drove them off. It would seem from the way they presented to their father when they say an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. So he knew, the shepherds would harass them. But the harassment was to drive them off and then take the water that they had drawn. Okay, so what would have happened? Let's say Moshe would not have intervened. So what would have happened is that, okay, they stole the water, they watered their sheep, they moved on. Now the girls would have to do the same thing over again. So it's wrong. It's an injustice. But it's not the same thing as someone being murdered. It's not the same thing. In other words, why does Moshe have to put his life on the line? That's another thing. In the first case, it's just one person. It's the Egyptian. And I guess Moshe, I think we can glean that Moshe knew how to fight. He was a strong person. He was a good fighter. But it's one-on-one. It's one against one. So one against one, okay. If you know how to fight, you can take him on. But here it's a gang. And a gang is always risking your life. Because even if you're a great fighter and all, when you're taking on a gang, a group, I don't know, even if it's four or five, whatever it is, so one guy can hold you down, the other guy can hit you over the head, someone can throw a rock at you. It's always, the danger increases tremendously. So why would he take a greater risk, put his life on the line, and for something which is that what the Torah is teaching us? There's plenty of injustices in the world. There's injustices all the time. Does that mean that every time there's an injustice, you have to start a fight and put your life on the line? And sometimes you have to, let's say someone cuts into your line. You see a parking spot and someone else grabs it and so on. It's an injustice. It's wrong. But if the person doing it seems to be, very arrogant and aggressive and dangerous, you're not going to start a fight. So you'll move on. You'll find another parking spot. I don't think anybody would advise someone to just get out and start fighting no matter what. That's not worth putting your life on the line. Here, too, my question is, what did Moshe see in all of this that would justify putting his life on the line? It's a minor annoyance. It's a theft. They stole the water. Okay, fine. So it messes up your day. Not something to put your life on the line. And my final question in this regard is, Moshe did two things. What were the two things?
He drove them off and he watered their sheep, or drew water for them?
He watered the sheep. So what's the question over here?
Why? They couldn't do it themselves?
Exactly. You see, you got to study it very carefully and the questions will just pop out. Why did he water the sheep? The Torah is mentioned, emphasizing, when they came home, they told their father, he drove off the shepherds and he drew the water for us and he watered the sheep. Why was it important to water the sheep? I mean, that's their job. There's no indication that they couldn't do it. So, I mean, I assume that Moshe acts with some kind of a rationality. Now, again, let's say you're going down the street and you hear a woman screaming from her house that because someone has broken in. And you're a courageous person and you run inside and you beat the guy. And you call the police, get rid of him. Then you're going to go and do her house cleaning for her? I mean, that doesn't make sense. That she could do for herself. That was not the problem. So here, too, the problem was not that they couldn't water the sheep. So all they needed was the protection from the shepherds. Once Moshe afforded that, so why did he water the sheep? And that's a good question. You got to find, if you can't find an answer, then there's something missing over here. Because the Torah is communicating that to us. There's something we need to learn from that. Okay, so those are my.
I would think it's sort of the opposite of Eliezer for Yitzchak.
Well, that's an entirely different situation. There was no aggression over there. That was totally different. He was searching for a appropriate wife. He set forth this test to see which girl would be so kind and compassionate. That I don't see any immediate connection at all.
Okay.
Does anybody else want to say something?
So you're trying to link all three events, the injustice, the watering of the flocks, the chasing them off.
Yeah, if you want to understand the story, like I think we've asked some penetrating questions, some challenging questions. Okay, but in order to get at the deeper idea of it, we have to try to put together some kind of an understanding. So let me see if I can explain it on the basis of Rashi. You all know who Rashi is, right? Rashi is the great Chumash Bible commentator.
Yeah.
So Rashi says when the Torah introduces us over here to the Kohen Midyan, I'll read to you from the Rashi's. So he says, who was the Kohen Midyan? He was their teacher, their leader, and he separated from Avodah Zarah, from idolatry. And they excommunicated. He was in a state of excommunication because, I told you, the religion of those days was the religion of idolatry. And when somebody separated from that, they condemned him and they put him in a state of excommunication. He was a outcast. Okay, fine. Then when it says, Rashi says, and the shepherds came and drove them away. So he says, because of the ban, because of the excommunication. So now we have more information. Because beforehand, we had no idea why did the shepherds drive the girls away. But now we see that it had a religious significance. It's because they had separate, they didn't worship idols. It's very similar, I guess, then to someone like Abraham. When he didn't worship idols, and the king wanted to kill him, have him killed. Here, they didn't have them killed, but they wanted to make life difficult for them. Okay? All right. So now the thing is like this. Moshe saw this and he understood this. And he knew that it wasn't a trivial matter anymore. Because that's the mission. The mission of the Jewish people is to teach the world, to remove themselves from any all forms of idolatry and to serve Hashem, to serve the true God. So he saw that they were trying to do that and that the shepherds were trying to break them. So it's not a trivial thing. It's not like somebody cutting into your line. This is a matter of life and death. If they were to be successful to make life so difficult for them, then they might give that, they might be weak. They might give up that, and they might return to idolatry in order not to be harassed. So that, it also, by the way, it also says that Moshe stood up and he saved them. That's a big word, Yeshua. Yeshua is like a saving. But again, if we're saying it's just a matter of water and inconvenience, so where was the big Yeshua over here? Where was the big salvation? Now we can understand. Because Moshe believed that he had the obligation to be the one who saves people because of their whole life. It is a matter of life and death. This was just as much, if not more, of a matter of life and death than the case with the Egyptian, because you could destroy a person physically or you could destroy a person spiritually. So if they were to get away with this and they would oppress the girls, then there was every danger that the girls might give in, might give up. And if somebody separates himself from idolatry and wants to serve Hashem and that person is being harassed, that's where the Jew has to step in. That's what Moshe did. And that's why it's a Yeshua. That's a real salvation, because we're talking about the stakes being so high. So that he had to take a risk for. That is, he didn't go in blindly. He was very powerful. He knew how to fight. True, there was the increased danger because you were fighting against the gang. But still, Moshe assessed that he had to take the risk because he has to save people from being pressured into idol worship. Okay, so we have these. I think that's that's a pretty convincing explanation of what's going on. I think it answers the questions that I raised. Okay, now that being said, I just want to close with one word, one further word. So Moshe had this quality of being a person who was opposed to injustice, but also he had to fight against it and to rescue the victim. Now, where did that quality come from? So if you go back to the beginning, it talks about the naming of Moshe. So you see from this that there's a name has significance. Because it says that Moshe stood up. I'm sorry. That the daughter of Paro, when she named him, it says she called his name Moshe. For I drew him from the water. I drew him from the water.
I guess that's some kind of Egyptian word.
Well, yeah, that's either an Egyptian word or some say it's the Hebrew equivalent of the Egyptian. But it doesn't really. My question is, so what kind of thing is that? What's the significance of I drew him from the water? That's just a fact. The generally, the name that they see, they didn't function the way we do with names. Today, people just name a person after someone else. They have this whole thing that the person died and doesn't have anybody named after them, that there's something lacking over here. But rather, no, they didn't follow that at all. Abraham's son was Yitzchak. Yitzchak's son was Yaakov and Esav. Now, where do you find any one of Yaakov's 12 sons? You don't find any one of them that's named after their grandfather or great-grandfather. So the name, this is the way the Sephorno, he's one of the commentators, the way he explains it is that we tend to think that Moshe means was drawn. For I drew him from the water. So Moshe would mean was drawn from the water. But the Sephorno says that's not the correct, in Hebrew that doesn't work. That is, in Hebrew, the past tense, it would have been Moshui, was drawn. But the term Moshe is will draw. In other words, the idea being that the name was supposed to signify from Moshe that because he was saved, he owes his existence to the fact that someone cared for him and helped him and saved him, that he then should go ahead and he should save others. That's what the name meant. So that's a powerful message. That's a name which has a powerful effect on the psyche. And he identified himself, he viewed himself as someone that has an obligation, has a special responsibility to come to the aid, to be the one born to rescue. That's what I named the title of today's class, if you notice. Born to rescue. Because the idea of rescuing the innocent is something which was part of his very existence. And because he was the beneficiary of that, and this was incorporated into his very essence, into his personality. So you see, that was his nature. That was his nature that when he saw people were the victims of injustice and oppression, he had this tremendous desire to intervene and to save them. In spite of that, when God charged him with the mission, you'd think if that's the case, well, he certainly would want to take the mission and become the leader of the Jews and take them out of Egypt. But that doesn't necessarily follow, because that he meant that he had to go into politics, and he regarded himself as being someone who was like the most opposite personality you can imagine to be a leader. He didn't have that kind of charisma. He had difficulty of speech. He had some kind of a speech defect. So that was his own assessment of himself, is that he couldn't see that he has any kind of ability to be a political leader, to go and negotiate. And because of that, he begged God to choose somebody else. But he couldn't prevail on that. He could not prevail. Because in point of fact, God knew that he had the best qualities. His humbleness, his absolute humbleness, and his absolute lack. You see, the thing that the biggest problem we have in leaders throughout all of history and in our time as well, that, you know, so many times, you know, we either elect or the leaders tend to become corrupt. Because the biggest motivating factor for most of the leaders is ego. And it's hard to find anyone that's, you know, to get to a leadership position requires tremendous determination, you know, perseverance, and the ability to have a thick skin, and then so on and so forth. What gives people the drive? The drive is ego. It's a tremendous, powerful thing, and all politicians partake of it. And that ultimately that becomes the downfall, because when there is a conflict between popularity and that which is best for the country, if a person's in there for ego, so then he's going to become corrupt. The corruption is built into the system. But the Torah says that the Moshe was the most humble man ever lived. That meant that he did not have the leadership ego. Everything that he did was purely for the service of God, for the sake of doing that which was best for the people. And that also can get, and he had to put up with tremendous unpopularity. Because if you're only dedicated to that which is truly good for the people, then the people are going to hate you also at times, because you're not giving in to their desires. But that is the factor which made him the most qualified person to be the leader. Okay, any last comments before we sign off? All right. Yeah, you can chew on it. You can think about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways, nice being with you tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, take care. Take care.
Have a good night.
Okay. Good night. You too. Have a good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
We'll be seeing you. Okay, bye. Quiet.